Good evening. If you would find your way to Ezekiel chapter 10 tonight. So glad to see some of you back from checking on your grandchild. But anyway, here we are. And I want to just sum up this chapter today with the title of Be Careful What You Wish For. Because what we're going to see today is really the culmination of centuries of disobedience, centuries of rebellion and just stubbornness against Yahweh. Because the Lord had taken His people, Israel. And oftentimes it's referred to as a marriage. You know, He is a husband to them throughout Scripture, but they're unwilling to be faithful to Him, although He is very much faithful to them. And that's summed up in the minor prophet Hosea as a picture of that infidelity of Israel being Gomer and the faithfulness of Yahweh represented by Hosea there. But just be careful what you wish for, because the people here in Israel or in Judah in this particular case, they're getting pretty much what they've wanted, what they've been not necessarily asking for, but it's kind of what their heart's been prompting and getting to since the Lord had led them out of Egypt. They've been this way. So, and you get inklings of this back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. The people there, they're going to Samuel and demanding a king. We want a king like all the other nations. And the Lord tells Samuel, it's not you they're rejecting. It's me. They don't want me to be king over them. They didn't want the Lord to be their king. They don't want God to be their king. They really don't want Him to be their God. And so as we get into chapter 10, chapter 10 is really just a continuation of what began back in chapter 8. In chapter 8, if you want to turn with me, we'll kind of just work our way up to this. In chapter 8, verse 1 there, Ezekiel is sitting in his house in Babylon. Remember now, he's exiled in Babylon for their disobedience. And he's there with these exiled elders of Judah, and they're all around him. And so the question is, why? Are they wanting to see what he prophesies next? You know, Ezekiel had been maybe become some kind of a sideshow for these guys. Are they wanting to actually hear from the Lord? Is that what they're wanting? More than likely, that's not going to be the answer. And probably they're discontent with their situation. Perhaps they believe that they've been unjustly judged by God, as if God overreacted. So Ezekiel is carried off in a vision to Jerusalem. It says the Lord pretty much took him by the hair of the head, you know, and just took him to Jerusalem, to the temple mainly. And when we get to verse 6 of chapter 8, it says there, "Do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me from my sanctuary, to drive me far from my sanctuary." Look, they don't want God. They don't want Yahweh. They want the blessings of God. They just don't want God. And he's telling them, do you see what they're doing? And you will see much greater abominations than this. So Ezekiel was given a glimpse of what the religious leaders are doing in chapter 8. Almost he's pulled the curtain back, or he's able to peek behind the wall and he sees what they're doing behind closed doors. And they're worshiping all these idols and creatures and crawling things. And he sees the women, as we work through chapter 8, as they're worshiping and weeping over the god Tammuz. Men, women, rich, poor, top to bottom, they're all godless. Jeremiah 11, because Ezekiel is carried to Jerusalem in a vision, but Jeremiah is actually in Jerusalem. Jeremiah says this in Jeremiah 11, verse 13. They have as many gods as they have cities, and they have as many altars as they have streets in Jerusalem. As many gods as they have cities, and as many altars as they have streets in Jerusalem. quite an idolatrous group. And this was intended, Jerusalem was intended to be a lighthouse to the world. But have you seen what they're doing? Then he goes down to verse 17. Then he said to me, "Have you seen this, O son of man?" Talking to Ezekiel. "Have you seen this? Is it too light of a thing for the house of Judah to commit these abominations that they commit here, that they should fill the land with violence?" It's almost as if this isn't enough. They're filling the land with violence. They're evil, they're wicked, they're cruel. So it's not just their religion and their hearts are going after other gods. They're just mean. The people in the city are giving over to idolatry and godlessness. That's plain. But not all. There remains a remnant, some who genuinely care for the glory of God. That's chapter 9. Chapter 9, the Lord commands the man clothed in linen to put a mark on the foreheads of some men. Now the man clothed in linen will mark those who will be spared from the outpouring of the Lord's wrath on Jerusalem. But I want you to note, this man clothed in linen who is doing the marking isn't randomly or haphazardly doing so. He's marking verse 4, chapter 9, verse 4. He's putting a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in Israel or in Jerusalem. So these marked men are those who love the Lord. These marked men are those who actually care for His glory. And should we assume that these righteous that are here, that they're just going to be collateral damage as the Lord judges Jerusalem? Is that what we should just assume? Maybe we should ask the same question that Abraham asked when the Lord made it known to him He was going to judge Sodom. Lord, would You sweep away the righteous with the wicked? In the case of Sodom, the Lord removes the righteous, Lot and his daughters, right? He took them out and then judged Sodom and Gomorrah. Here in this case, the Lord is going to mark those who will be spared. And as He destroys the city, they will be spared. This is not a sloppy military exercise. This is precise. This is just. And this is judgment. And as soon as the marking is complete, Ezekiel again is going to see the vision of the glory of the Lord. The same vision he saw back in chapter 1. So let's pick back up in chapter 10. Let's read verses 1 and 2. "Then I, Ezekiel, looked, and behold, on the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, there appeared above them something like a sapphire, in appearance like a throne. And he said to the man clothed in linen, 'Go in among the whirling wheels underneath the cherubim, fill your hands with burning coals from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city.' And he went in before my eyes." So this throne, this is going to be the same vision we saw back in chapter 1. It's really indescribable. He's trying to describe the indescribable because he's getting a vision of the glory of Yahweh. But here, it mentions the throne. The same throne's mentioned back in chapter 1. But there it mentions that there's one seated on the throne in the likeness of a man with human appearance. That's what we read in chapter 1. Here, the one seated on the throne is just going to be implied. The one on the throne is going to be the one speaking to the man in linen, the man clothed in linen. So when it says, "Then I looked, and behold, on the expanse there was over the heads of the cherubim, there appeared above them something like a sapphire, in appearance like a throne." So the one on the throne here said to the man clothed in linen, "Go in among the whirling wheels." And he said, that's the way our translations read. Some translations actually will actually put the Lord there. So it says, "And the Lord said to the man clothed in linen," which is exactly what's going on there. The NIV actually says that, "When Yahweh said to the man clothed in linen." which this just contextually fits everything we've been reading from chapter 8, as we began back in chapter 8. The Lord said to Ezekiel, "Do you see what they are doing?" We just read this. "The great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary." The me and the my, those personal pronouns. There's no doubt that Yahweh is the one communicating with Ezekiel. In chapter 9, verse 4, the Yahweh said, chapter 9, verse 10, "As for me, my eye will not spare, nor I will I have pity. I will bring their deeds upon their heads." So you see, it's still those personal pronouns. I, me, my, I want my judgment, my house, my sanctuary. Yahweh is the one who's running this show. So Yahweh, the Lord, is the one who is going to speak to this man clothed in linen. And he tells him to go in among the whirling wheels and fill your hands with these burning coals from between the cherubim. So he goes in. He doesn't go into the temple. That's when it says that at the end of verse 2. He's going in between these whirling wheels to gather these burning coals. The one on the throne is the one speaking to him. And the one he's speaking to is the one who just got through marking the men. So the one who previously was the one who was going around making those marks of mercy is now the one being used to exercise God's judgment. So, now this, as he goes in and he gets these burning coals and brings them out, it says that he is to scatter them over the city. Now this is not going to be for purification. You know, we oftentimes read this in the Old Testament. For instance, Isaiah. We read in Isaiah 6. Hang with me. Isaiah gets a vision of the glory of the Lord as Yahweh is sitting on a throne, right? And he says, "Woe is me, for I am lost. For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hands a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for." So in Isaiah, we see that this burning coal is used for purification purposes. But here, these hot coals are judgment. There's no question about it. Contextually, we're reading about judgment. And he is to get in there and scatter them all over the city. Get these hot burning coals and scatter them all over the city. Again, it's just so easy to refer to Jeremiah because Jeremiah is actually in Jerusalem. You know, Ezekiel was in Jerusalem, exiled out. He's back in a vision, seeing what's going on behind closed doors, what's going on among the women. He just sees, he basically gets a glimpse through the eyes of Yahweh on how sinful these people really are and how just God is to in His judgment. So, as Jeremiah is there, the Lord tells Jeremiah, Jeremiah 17, verse 27, the Lord says this, "If you do not listen to me, then I will kindle a fire in Jerusalem, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem, and it shall not be quenched." So that is what the Lord told Jeremiah. So the question is, well, do the people listen? He says, if you don't listen, I'm going to kindle a fire that will not be quenched. Do they listen? The answer is absolutely not. He's already told Ezekiel here, back in chapter 3, that the people of Israel will not listen to you, Ezekiel, because they're not willing to listen to me. So the people will not listen to God. So, if they don't listen to him, he's going to kindle a fire. And here we see this man clothed in linen accumulating those coals and scattering over the city, which is exactly what happens in 2 Kings chapter 25. There's a man by the name of Nebuzaradan. He is the captain of the bodyguard. He's Nebuchadnezzar's official, Nebuchadnezzar's commander. He came to Jerusalem and he burned, this is the Babylonian commander, he came to Jerusalem and he burned the house of the Lord. He burned the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every great house he burned down. So Babylon, in fact, comes in and burns down every great house. The king's house, all the palaces, the temple, everything. Just like the Lord had warned the people in Jeremiah. And just like we see happening here with the man clothed in linen. The Lord had warned them and he'd follow through with his warning. Not no idle, empty threats that parents often give their kids. And we see Babylon being the instrument God used to carry this out. Now, as we move into verse 3 through 5, in my opinion, this is going to be parenthetical because he's being told the man in linen to go in, get these burning coals, and then he goes in to get those coals from before my eyes. Verse 3. Now the cherubim were standing on the south side of the house when the man went in. And a cloud filled the inner court. And the glory of the Lord went up from the cherubim to the threshold of the house. And the house was filled with the cloud. And the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. And the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when He speaks. Again, this is, I think, parenthetical. He's just kind of describing where the cherubim were at this particular time and how it sounded and how it looked. But this cloud, it mentions here, where it said that the glory of the Lord went up from the cherubim to the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the glory of the brightness of the Lord there. This cloud is going to be a representation of the glory of Yahweh. We see this throughout the Old Testament as well. At the dedication of the tabernacle, when Moses dedicated the tabernacle in Exodus 40, verse 34, it says back there, the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. It was actually called the cloud of the Lord. And it was kind of done to maybe as a veil, as a way to protect them from seeing the glory of God in His fullness. At the dedication of the temple, when Solomon dedicated the temple, 1 Kings chapter 8, when the priest came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So the glory of the Lord is going to be used synonymous with this cloud here. So what Ezekiel was seeing is this cloud is filling this temple, is filling the court. The court's going to be filled with the brightness of the glory of God. So we get 6 and 7. We're going to return back to the man clothed in linen who's gathering these burning coals. And when he commanded, the one on the throne, the Lord commanded the man clothed in linen to take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim. He went in and stood beside a wheel. And the cherub stretched out his hand from between the cherubim to the fire that was between the cherubim, and took some of it and put into the hands of the man clothed in linen, who took it and went out. So you see, we kind of returned back to at the end of verse 2 there. Returned back to the man clothed in linen who is doing exactly as he's commanded. And it says here that he took these coals, these hot burning coals, and he went out. It doesn't really read, we don't read about him scattering these hot coals as he was commanded to do, but it is implied, and I think it's right to assume, rightly assume, that he does exactly as Yahweh had commanded him. So as we're fixing to get this vision again that we had in chapter 1, and I know a lot of y'all are maybe have high expectations, and I'm just going to let the air out of that balloon. Not going to have it answered here today. Because there's, again, it's just the indescribability of Yahweh. It has to be what we notice here. So I'll read 8 through 17. Get a big chunk of it right here. So the cherubim appeared to have the form of a human hand under their wings. And I looked, and behold, there were four wheels beside the cherubim, one beside each cherub. And the appearance of the wheels was like sparkling beryl. And as for their appearance, the four had the same likeness, as if a wheel were within a wheel. When it went, they went in any of their four directions, without turning as they went. But in whatever direction the front wheel faced, the other wheels followed without turning as they went. And their whole body, their rims, their spokes, their wings, and their wheels were full of eyes all around. The wheels that the four of them had, as for the wheels, they were called, in my hearing, the whirling wheels. And everyone had four faces. The first face was the face of a cherub. The second face was that of a human face. The third face of that of a lion. And the fourth face, that of an eagle. And the cherubim mounted up. These were the living creatures that I saw by the Kabar Canal. See, we're right back to chapter 1 there. And the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. And when the cherubim lifted up their wings to mount up from the earth, the wheels did not turn from beside them. When they stood still, they stood still. And when they mounted up, these mounted up with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in them. So everything here you see operating in unison. You know, when they go up, they go up. When they stand still, they stand still. Right? Nothing's kind of operating independently. They're all operating in unison, and everything is going to move at the direction of God. That's one of the things that we can draw from this. Another thing is that Yahweh, again, is sovereign over this whole thing. He was sovereign over their captivity as they're carried off into Babylon, and he's going to be sovereign over Jerusalem as a city is going to be sacked for the third and final time. So it says here, again, he references back. This is the same vision. This is the same one I saw back in chapter 1, back at the Kabar Canal. He's real quick to point that out. Now, there is one difference in the vision we have in chapter 1 and the one we have here. And I'm sure some of you, when you read it, like, oh, that don't... Maybe you didn't. All right, there's four faces on the one we have here. We have the face of a cherub, the face of a human face, the third face of a lion, and the fourth face of an eagle. Chapter 1, there was a face of an ox. The ox kind of replaced the cherub here. Now, I don't really know. There's a host of opinions on or interpretations on what this actually means. Some Feinberg, I think, actually made the point that the ox was had a servant attitude and served the owner here, and the cherub are doing the same thing to Yahweh. So in the same way that an ox would be an animal of servitude, this cherub is a creation of servitude for Yahweh. So he just replaces it. I'm not sure. But we know he saw it, and I believe he wrote what he saw. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. So then we get into verses 18 and 19. And this is where Todd kind of primed the pump last week. And again, we'll let the air out of that balloon as well. So verse 18. Then the glory of the Lord went out from the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim. And the cherubim lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth before my eyes as they went out, with the wheels beside them. And they stood at the entrance of the east gate of the house of the Lord, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them. So we see the glory of the Lord beginning to exit. Here. It's beginning to leave. The glory of the Lord went out from the threshold of the house and went and stood above the cherubim, kind of standing beside the throne is what we have to picture there. And they lifted up their wings, mounted up before the earth, and they left, right? And they stood at the entrance of the east gate at the house of the Lord. So, again, the glory of the Lord is beginning to exit. He begins to exit, and he pauses what it seems like here at the entrance of the east gate. So he's leaving. He kind of gets on that chariot and they're leaving and they just stop. They pause. No mad rush to leave. And we read this and just the people of Israel, as Ezekiel is describing this, the people of Israel, I don't think they really understand the gravity of the situation. They're unaware of everything that's going on around them. And frankly, they don't care. You know, back, you know, we began this thing in chapter 8. This whole thing began in chapter 8. Verse 6, remember we read it earlier, it said, the things that they were doing was intended to drive him far away from them. They wanted him out, gone, like you would run off a stray dog. Get kind of right back to 1 Samuel 8. Same way the people didn't want God to be king over them. They wanted a human king that they could control. Here, the people, they don't want Yahweh to be God over them. They want a man-made God that they can control. They take for granted the privilege of being the people of God. They underestimate their sin, which seems to be the reason as to why Yahweh grabbed Ezekiel and brought him to, you know, Jerusalem and said, "Do you see what they're doing? Do you see what they're doing?" They underestimate the holiness of God. And they wrongly assume that the Lord was bound to bless them regardless of their behavior. You know, the Lord's relationship with Israel is often referred to in a marriage. In Israel, the wife doesn't desire her husband. She wants her freedom to sin, her freedom to chase after every lust of her heart. But she does desire the blessings of God. She does desire the blessings of her husband. I guess in a way it'd be like alimony, right? Separation, but I want support. That's where she's at. Separation with support. The blessings, they anticipate them. They expect them. But all those blessings that come their way will never fill the void of an estranged wife without her husband. They will never fill the void of an estranged people without their God. That's the incredible sadness of this whole thing, that the people are without their God, and they're numb to the whole situation. And they downplay the seriousness of the absence of God. And there are some in Babylon who've been carried away because of their collective sin, who are in Babylon, Ezekiel and Daniel, just to name two, who would desire to worship God in the temple. And they can't. They're in Babylon. And there are those who have the ability and access to worship God, and they have absolutely no desire. And we see all these characteristics on display in our culture. From a people who don't want God over them, from a people who expect and even demand blessings from God, acceptance from God, name it and claim it, right? If I say it, you're duty bound to give it to me. So numb to the things of God that they can't even discern when He's not present. You know, you see this in many of the, I guess you could say, liberal, progressive churches. So numb to the things of God that they don't even know that He's not there. And He's actually against them. And that there's some, even in our culture, with a desire to worship, and they just cannot assemble. You know, COVID put us on that for quite some time, and some people took that COVID restriction for years. While some have the freedom, all the freedom in the world to assemble, and they just choose not to. So we kind of see the people of Israel. We're not all that much different. Let's finish this real quick, and then we'll get some application. 20 through 22. These were the living creatures that I saw underneath the God of Israel by the Kabar Canal, and I knew that they were cherubim. Each had four faces, each had four wings, and underneath their wings the likeness of human hands. And as for the likeness of their faces, they were the same faces whose appearance I had seen by the Kabar Canal. Each one of them went straight forward. So Ezekiel here seems to be reiterating what he had seen. He's very clear about, I saw this. I knew what I saw, right? I saw it. I knew I saw it. He's reinforcing what he had previously saw. He said, I saw it with my own eyes. You know, I didn't miss Gage, I didn't misread the situation. This is exactly what I saw. And it was Yahweh as he's mounting up his chariot and leaving the temple. The glory of the Lord is leaving the temple. In chapter 10, the glory of the Lord is beginning to exit, and he pauses at the eastern gate. That's what we just read. He paused when he got to the eastern gate. Now, in chapter 11, this is two sermons away, so I'm not getting all over them. Chapter 11, verse 22, we're going to see the completeness of that departation. He's going to depart. Chapter 11, verse 22. Then the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain that is on the east side of the city. You see, he's left the city, which is what they wanted, or so they thought. So he left the city and stood on the east side, on the mountains that are on the east side of the city. That is the Mount of Olives, by the way. If you want to look over in chapter 43, just so I don't leave you without hope, this is quite some time away. I'll just read one verse. I'll read a few verses, but anyway. Chapter 43, verse 1. Then he led me to the gate facing east, the one that the Lord was departing, the one he just stopped at. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the east. And the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters. And the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw was just like the vision I saw when he came to destroy the city, the one we just read in chapter 10. Just like the vision that I'd seen by the Kabar Canal. And I fell on my face, verse 4, as the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east. Right? So the same way he left out, it's going to be the same way he comes back. Just hypothetically, if you had to take a guess, do you want to take a guess on which gate Jesus entered when he entered Jerusalem? If you guessed the east, you would be right. We can read Matthew 21 at the triumphal entry. I'm not saying that's the ultimate fulfillment of this, but it's definitely all the signs of his messiahship were present. Matthew 21, as it talks about the triumphal entry, he leaves from the Mount of Olives, east, and he enters Jerusalem in the east gate. He entered from the Mount of Olives. He entered through the east gate. The glory of the God of Israel came into the house of God just as he said he would. Their king was in their midst, but they do not see it. They completely miss them. So we wait. And maybe there's another parallel here. As we read in chapter 10, as the Lord was leaving the temple, he stopped at that east gate before he went to the Mount of Olives, right? And as Jesus is leaving the temple, he stops at the gate. He says in Matthew 23, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then he departs. Do you see all the signs of the Messiahship just right in front of their face? Have you ever noticed, or do you ever look at like Jerusalem? Maybe some of you have been there or on the internet and seen pictures of the temple and try to get a visual picture of the temple. Have you seen pictures of the temple, whether in person, on the internet, of the temple precincts today? If you'll notice, you may know this picture, but not know exactly which gate it is. The eastern gate is completely sealed off. Just Google it. There's a big gate, a beautiful gate there, and it's blocked, cement, thick, sealed off. The Muslims sealed this gate. Some say they did it for security reasons as they took the city. Others say, no, they did it to prevent the God of Israel from entering the city. And if you actually look at that sealed gate, right outside that sealed gate, today they've erected a graveyard. Right outside that gate. No Jew would defile himself by coming in contact with a dead body. You read that and you look at this and you laugh. You know, to assume that a cement structure would hinder the Lord from fulfilling His promise? Chuckle. But then we can cry. But how can a Muslim know and believe more about the Scriptures than we do? Why is it that a Muslim believes in a literal interpretation of Ezekiel? And many American Christians just want to spiritualize it away. Why is that? The glory of the God of Israel is going to return. Just like He says here. He will enter by the east gate. Just as He says. Cement wall, graveyard, makes no difference. Read Zechariah 14. It's talking about on that day when He comes, He will come and He will stand on the Mount of Olives and the land will split. Exactly, you know, as Jesus ascended to heaven, He ascended from the Mount of Olives, and those angels told the men as they were standing there gazing into heaven, why are you gazing into heaven? He who left will come right back to where He came from. He will come in the same manner, in the same way that He left. Jesus is coming right back to where He left from. Yahweh is coming right back from where He left from. The glory of the Lord is coming right back from where He left from and going right back through that east gate. Just the way He left. There's so much beauty in the way He left. There's so much heartbreak in the way that He left. You know, you have those signs where He's just receive them. He's right here. He's filling all these promises. But no, they didn't want the Yahweh of the Old Testament. They didn't want the Messiah, Jesus, Yahweh in the flesh, as we read the Gospels. So it's easy to just categorize these people as some kind of just extreme rebellious people. And they are extremely rebellious. But we see it in the Gospels. We see that same rebellion, that same disobedience, that same hard-heartedness that we see it today is all the things that we're blessed and have the ability to do and we just kind of just take them for granted and just expect God to consistently bless us and be there for us and oftentimes don't even know when He's gone. Like these people, don't even know when He's gone. So they definitely got what they wished for back in chapter 8. They were wanting to drive Him away, and without question, He left. And I think they just didn't know what they were asking for. I'm afraid we, as a people, may be heading in the same direction. But anyway, if you would please stand, we'll pick up in chapter 11 next week.